Broadcasting from the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C., welcome to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series searching for ways to create a world free of violent conflict and finding them in the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. And on today's show, we continue our series covering 60 days of engagement around youth, gender, and peace. For those of you who are new to the 60 days of engagement, here is what it's all about. On August 12th, the world celebrated International Youth Day. Coming up on September 21st, the world will celebrate International Peace Day. And on October 11th, the world will celebrate the International Day of the Girl Child. These 3 days span about 60 days, and we at the Peace Frequency and USIP are seizing this opportunity to bring increased attention to how young people are integral to peacebuilding and how peacebuilding work is made stronger and more effective when viewed and understood through a gendered lens. USIP, along with a number of other organizations, are hosting events, spreading awareness, and providing educational opportunities that touch on these 3 themes of youth, peace, and gender equality. Joining me in the studio today is Dr. Alana Lancaster. Alana is a senior program officer at USIP, where she specializes in curriculum and training design and delivery, trainer development, and university partnerships. For the past few years, Alana has been one of the Academy's most prolific trainers of African peacekeepers, having led more than 30 trainings, probably 40 at this point. Prior to joining USIP, she was an assistant professor at American University's International Training and Education Program, of which I'm alum, props to that, and a Peace Corps volunteer in Botswana. So, Alana, thanks for being on the podcast with us today.
Happy to be here.
Good.
Thank you.
I'm also joined in the studio by one of my USIP colleagues, Aubrey Cox. Aubrey is a senior program specialist who manages the Generation Change Program, which works with young leaders across the globe to foster collaboration, build resilience, and strengthen capacity as they transform local communities. So Aubrey will be following the questions and comments from our listening and viewing audience throughout today's show. So if you're listening to this broadcast on the Peace Frequency webpage, please post your questions and comments in the discussion forum at the bottom of that page, and we'll bring them into the show. If you're watching us on Facebook Live, you can post your questions and comments in the discussion thread below the live feed. So hello to all of our Facebook friends. And you can tweet your questions using the hashtag YouthPeaceEquality. Again, that's hashtag YouthPeaceEquality. And that is, by the way, the official hashtag of the 60 days of engagement. So start thinking about your questions and your comments. Now we're going to be speaking about gender inclusivity, especially as it pertains to education. So we want to bring those questions in as many times and as soon as we can so your voices can influence the show. So with that, let's get started. Now, Alana, we start all of our podcasts with a behind the bio question. It's a question that in your response will in some way hopefully reveal something about your character, your motivations, your inspirations, etc. And so because today's podcast is focusing on gender, I thought that our behind the bio question could revolve around that. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So the question is, who is one person of your gender that you hold as a role model and why?
Of my gender. So I think I would have to say my grandmother, Jessie. This is my father's mother, Jessie Lancaster. And she's a role model for me because she was very much a local historian, Native Washingtonian. And documented local history, or quite a bit of oral history. I have learned a lot about the city and what it meant to be Black in the 30s and 40s. And so I would have to say my grandmother.
Okay, nice. Is she still with us?
She has passed.
She has passed.
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry to hear that. So how much time did you spend with her growing up?
I mean, quite a bit.
Quite a bit.
Yeah,
okay.
Quite a bit. I remember sitting at her kitchen table, and I was a big fan of my grandmother's sauerkraut, believe it or not. And she would make sauerkraut, and I would eat the sauerkraut, and we would just talk. And we talked a lot about the state of the African-American community. And I think even as I look back on it and reflect, also gender, in fact, although I'm not so sure we use that language or that framework, but what it meant to be a Black woman as well. So, yeah.
That's great. That's great. Thanks for sharing.
Absolutely.
And who is a person of another gender who you view as a role model?
It'd be my grandfather. It would be James Bernard Lancaster Sr. I think similarly to my grandmother was very verbal, very vocal. My grandfather was a lot quieter, a little bit more of an observer, a man of deep spirituality, as was my grandmother. The way in which he, a deep humanist as well. Again, I don't think that my grandparents would talk about themselves in that language, but the respect that my grandfather had for everyone, and modeling that kind of respect and compassion and a sense of treating people well and treating people as and engaging people with their humanity. I think
that's great.
Yeah. And I think my grandparents pass that along to my father and his siblings, his sisters, and of course then onto us as well.
That's great. Well, I think this might actually, in some way, I'm hearing it may have motivated what you decided to focus on as you went and earned your PhD. And so it's mentioned in the description of this podcast and your bio that in your 2008 dissertation was titled Racing, Classing, and Gendering School-Related Violence in 3 Johannesburg Secondary Schools. So I'd love for you to take us back about 10 years ago when you started this process. Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome.
I started the process long before 10 years ago.
I was about to say, I was like 10, maybe 15 years ago.
I started my coursework in 2002. So
wow, nice. Good on you. Well, take us back to 2002.
Okay.
And how did you and why did you start looking at this particular topic and this particular topic in South Africa?
Right. So I'm an educator. I love teaching and learning. I love thinking about teaching and learning and talking about teaching and learning. I love policy, education policy as well. I'm also a student of the African continent. I first found myself on the continent about 25 years ago, and I've been living on and off and working on and off the continent for the past 25 years or so. Also thinking about the intersectional lens of race, class, and gender. I was interested in school-related violence. South Africa, because in particular, why South Africa and not another country? Practically, because it's English speaking. And also because I had done some research there. I collaborated with my professor at the time, Dr. Carol Ann Spring, and we were working on a project in schools in South Africa. So I also did a policy course there at University of Witwatersrand. So I think I had connections there. As you know, South Africa has one of the highest rates of gender-based violence. And I was really interested in understanding kind of the intersection of structural cultural violence, institutional violence, and interpersonal violence. That's what took me to Johannesburg.
When you say gender-based violence, what do you mean by that?
Violence based on gender. So gender being is socially constructed as opposed to notions of biological sex. You know, you're born a boy or born a girl, possibly. You know, gender is something that we actively do. It's a process. It's society, and we participate in it. So violence is based, gender-based violence is based on the way in which an individual identifies. I'll stop there.
Now, I want to go back to your grandmother, your role model, who's a historian, mm-hmm. and taught you a lot about, Black history, particularly in Washington, D.C. So you grew up in the Washington, D.C. area?
Okay. And you did as well?
I did as well, yes. Born in Washington, D.C. Grew up in Arlington, actually.
Yeah, right.
Did you see do you feel like there are any elements of your childhood growing up, going to schools in the DC area? Did you go to school in Washington,
DC? Montgomery County kid.
Montgomery County kid. Okay.
Graduate. Yeah.
When you started this research,
yeah.
you were learning about South Africa, you're in Johannesburg, thinking about gender-based violence. Did any of that have you reflect back on your experience growing up in Montgomery County schools when you were deeply immersed in these questions?
Yeah, so gender-based violence was an element. Gender-based violence was an element of my dissertation. But as I mentioned before, I was also very interested in structural, cultural, and institutional violence and in how it articulates an individual interpersonal violence. So how a learner experiences violence in their school and beyond, in their broader school community. And I think one element or one of the themes that emerged in my doctoral work was the way in which schools can be very affirming places and affirm identity, or schools can be places that really alienate individuals and individual identity. And I would argue that that in itself is a violence, right? So if your identity, whether it's your race identity or your classed identity or gendered identity, is not being positively affirmed, and you're getting messages from your teachers, from other students, that doesn't honor who you are, that in itself it undermines your spirit, and it's a spirit injury, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So you perhaps experienced.
Thank you. Back to that. Yeah. So I did experience a little bit of that in Montgomery County schools. I think what we know about school segregation, it's still very current. And when we do, we know that we're a little bit, in the United States in particular, we're more segregated today than we were at the height of desegregation in the 1970s. In the case of my particular school, we had some diversity. I think we were at the time about 10-12% diverse learners. But what we saw in my school, and as we saw in other schools of the time, and we still see today, is we have basically tracking. And so we see segregation across race in the classroom environment. So that is to say, if you go to AP classes and gifted and talented classes, it's majority white, and there are very few people of color, and I was one of those very few people of color. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really difficult space. While there was more diversity outside, most African Americans and Latinos were, in basic level classes, and so there was a hierarchy, and there was some tracking going on at the time. Mm-hmm. I would argue still goes on in many schools today.
Certainly. Well, over the past couple of weeks, as part of the 60 Days of Engagement, we've been posting questions online that are inviting people to reflect on their own experiences and perspectives on gender. And so I'd like to hear your responses to some of these questions. I mean, we've touched on them a little bit already,
right?
But it'd be great for you to respond to some of the same questions that folks online have been. So one of those questions was, what messages did you receive when you were younger about male and female, man and woman gender roles?
So I think some of the earliest messaging that we get is from our family and our parents. I think that my parents, my mom, of course, I'm a child of the 70s, I'm dating myself now, but I'm a child of the 70s, and my mother was very much involved in the civil rights movement, but also the women's rights movement. And I think my mother was very progressive in the way in which she parented. I have a sister and a brother, the way in which we were parented. So my mother, and my father as well, had both my brother, and my brother and I are closer in age. He's 18 months older, and my sister is 4 years older than I am. We had dolls, both my brother and I both had dolls. My mom was really into, do you remember, I think it's made a resurgence, but Free to Be You and Me, Marlo Thomas.
I can't say I've heard of that. No. Free to Be You and Me.
Yeah,
Google that, everybody.
Yeah, please do. I think it made a resurgence at some time, but basically it was a record, and there was a TV show that went along with that. But Marlo Thomas developed this in the 70s as a tool to help parents and children to think about gender in different ways, and gender identities and gender messages. So, I remember playing that album all the time growing up as a kid. kid. And so I think my parents worked really hard to give us different messages about the roles of so it was okay for boys to cry, you know. It was okay for girls to be assertive. And my mother is very assertive, and I was assertive as well. So when I was in elementary school, I felt that I was at times a little bit too assertive for the expectations that my teachers may have had for me. Again, about messages that boys and girls get in school. So we know that boys are encouraged to be assertive and to express themselves, whereas girls are expected to be a little bit quieter in the classroom and less assertive. So there was a bit of a transition from my home environment where my parents worked really hard to kind of be subversive around gender understandings and traditional gender expectations, because we do gender. Gender is, it's an active, actively reproduce gender. I think my parents were really trying to interrupt the problematic notions of gender, but then in school, of course, and then within my peer groups as well. So in the playground, it was often, and girls line up on one side, boys line up on the other side. It was in terms of the way in which we played, girls played together, boys played, so girls did hopscotch and boys did, kickball.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. And then maybe we would do four square together in terms of playing, but that, the messages come from the teachers, come from parents, come from peers. And it just kind of continues along throughout, a life cycle, really.
Mm-hmm. I was even thinking a lot about this just during the recent Olympics where you stand back and say, wait, why don't women compete in this event?
Yeah.
Some of these more, extreme or longer events are only men compete in them.
Absolutely.
And so there's still so many cases where it just boggles the mind who made the decision that women aren't capable of doing the 1500 meter swimming. They're
Absolutely.
Not capable of doing the whatever. And it wasn't until recently that they were even allowed to run the marathon.
Yeah.
Think about Kathy Switzer, talk about an assertive, powerful woman who's like, why are women banned from running in the marathon? We can do this. And she went in there and broke the rules. And
I think also interesting, I'm glad you brought up this example of Olympics, because I want to talk a little bit to think about the way in which peers, so I'm thinking about the runners, and I'm thinking about Casper and her, this question about her gendered identity,
right.
And how other Olympians who ran in the races with her, and also the fact that, three African women did really well, and the Polish woman who kind of spoke out and said, so this idea of what is femininity, and what is who is a woman, and the critiques basically because these women are presented, there was questions about these women's gendered identity, right? And that's problematic because we're policing each other.
Right. Maybe some of our listeners may not know, or viewers may not know, Caster Semenya, the South
thank
African
you.
Runner.
Yeah. Escaping the last name was escaping me.
So what's the story behind that? Could you touch on a little bit, but maybe give us a little bit more background on the issue?
So the issue is that there are questions about whether or not Casper was born a woman or a man. So she's biologically a woman or biologically a man, and biological determinism and what that means for Olympic competition. So if she there are questions about was she born a man or was she born a woman or a different biological. And so the Olympic Committee said indeed that she was is a woman, but then we see that there is the controversy is around the fact that people are questioning the Olympic decision, and I this is where I would bring the intersectional lens in as well in the critique, because she's a Black woman, and she's she's a champion, right?
And so super athlete, right?
He's a super athlete, and I think there are some people who really are struggling with that in general. So
And you mentioned earlier that we do gender all the time, so I'm gonna kind of put you on the spot here and analyze this situation a bit. How are we gendering right now? What are you picking up in terms of how we express our different genders?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
So I have to say, Darren, I think you're pretty progressive, if you will. I think you're pretty tuned in. If I may say, our Facebook Live folk can see this, but you have nail polish on your fingers.
Yes, I do.
You want to talk a little bit about that, the nail polish on your fingers? And because I would suggest that's a little bit transgressive, if you will, right? Because it's not what we tend to associate with behavior. Of how a man should behave, the fact that he has, nail polish. And you consistently, I've noticed this, you consistently wear nail polish.
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think the main reason why I actually started wearing nail polish was because I have a daughter, she's 4.5. And so she got interested in nail polish and it's something that she's interested in. So I figure I should be interested in it as well. I want to be interested in it as well. But what I realized in doing that is that adding color to your body, you know, is fun and interesting in the same way that I'd make color choices for my shirt or a hat that I wear or my socks or whatever.
Right.
It's just another part of my body that I can put some color on and express myself. So I'm like, I get it now that I've like tried it on and whatnot. And then I think the other reason is, and many years ago, I had a great encounter, like a week-long encounter with someone named Victor Lee Lewis. And if people don't know who he is, if you've ever watched the documentary film, The Color of Fear, which is about dialogue and the power of dialogue. Yeah. And this particular documentary was about dialogues around race and identity. And Victor Lee Lewis is one of the participants in this dialogue. And so I had the opportunity to meet him and chat with him about what he's done since then. And a lot of his work is around challenging these gender norms, some of which can be very violent. Yeah. And, you know, he said something that, you know, some men will just choose to wear nail polish on all their fingers or just one of their fingers as a way to communicate a message of why is there this block that men are put in that you're not supposed to wear nail polish?
Absolutely.
I mean, just to make that rule, when you just say it without thinking about all the context behind it is ridiculous. It's like, no, men don't wear nail polish. Well, why not? Same thing. Men don't wear skirts or dresses, at least in this United States, American culture. In other cultures, they do wear things that would be considered more of a skirt or a dress. And so he's like, it's maybe subtle or not so subtle way to challenge what is considered a default way to express yourself as a man. And so it all came together, I think, when my daughter was like, oh, I want to, paint nails. I said, yeah, all right, so do I. And hey, this is actually, I like this, you know, it makes me feel a certain way. So,
I appreciate that. I appreciate you modeling gender, progressive norms, that to me, that's what you're doing with your daughter, because I know, not every man would be comfortable in that. And wearing nail polish, and I appreciate you saying you actually enjoy it too.
But I will say, I mean,
yeah,
I only have 2 nails painted on each finger. I haven't painted all my fingers, and sometimes I ask myself, what's preventing me from just painting all my fingers? And she's asked me that. Mm. She's like, "Oh, Daddy, you only painted one, or you only painted 2." And there's this thing inside me. I'm like, I don't know how to respond to that. There's something that's preventing me from painting all my nails. And so I still struggle with that a little bit, where I'm like, well, I'll do it, but I only do it a little bit. I don't want to do too much or whatever. So
may I ask you a couple questions?
Sure.
So now I'm kind of changing gender dynamic a little bit, because as a man, right, you're kind of controlling the agenda, but you're also the host here. Could I ask you, would you have been comfortable in wearing nail polish on your nails in primary school, in secondary school, even in university? How comfortable would you have been in wearing nail polish?
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
And what do you think would have happened if you wore nail polish in school?
I think there certainly would have been negative comments. It would have been poked fun of. I would have been questioned in an elementary, middle school type way and not have the vocabulary or understanding and how to respond in an effective way. And I don't think I necessarily would have been, I don't know how I would or would not have been supported by teachers and administrators at that time. So I don't want to make a blanket statement about the school that I went to.
Right.
But I certainly would not have had the courage. I think I dealt with enough stuff,
Right.
So why add another thing that someone could potentially pick out about me that's different? Yeah.
And how's your partner feel about you wearing nail polish?
She loves it. It's great. Yeah. She's actually not a nail polish wearer at all. But I think she just likes to see, you know, me and Kaya do stuff together, and is certainly supportive of the fact that it does show her that this is something that men and boys can do. And then it's normal because it's normal in her house. So, well, let's move on.
Okay.
So for folks, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Peace Frequency. It's a podcast series searching for ways to create a world free of violent conflict and finding them in the stories of people around the globe who are making peace possible. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and on today's show, we're speaking with Dr. Alana Lancaster, Senior Program Officer at the United States Institute of Peace and a globe-trotting peace builder, trainer, and educator. We invite all of our listeners and our viewers to share your questions and your comments with us throughout the show. If you're listening to us on the Peace Frequency webpage, you can post your questions and comments in the forum space at the bottom of the page. If you're watching us on Facebook Live, please post your questions and comments in the feed under in the space underneath the feed. And you can also tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag #YouthPeaceEquality, and we'll bring it into the show. But we're exploring issues of gender, and I want to turn the show now to issues of gender and how they manifest themselves in educational spaces, particularly classrooms and primary and secondary classrooms. So let's step back a bit first and have you explain to us some of the key words that we've already been using that always come to the surface when people talk about this. Gender, which you've touched on a bit already, diversity, and inclusion. So recap for us again, what is gender and how is it different than sex?
Right. So gender is really refers to this idea that the roles that we take on are ascribed by society. So men in the notion of biology is that, you know, you're born a man, you're born a woman. But we know that, as I mentioned before, gender is not about biology. It's not about about being a boy and being a girl. Rather, gender is about the roles, how we're socialized to be boys and girls and to be women and men.
Okay.
So it's a social construction.
Okay. Okay. And then diversity. What is diversity and how is that different than inclusion or inclusivity?
Yeah. So for me, so diversity refers to kind of difference. It's this range of human differences. So it's and what we talk about a lot in the U.S. is race. It can be ethnicity or tribe. It can be gender or gender identity. It can be your sexual orientation, your age. That is diversity. It's based on a range of differences. And I think a lot of institutions, organizations, schools, especially at the higher education level, so university, talk about diverse student population or diverse student body. And diversity for me is just, so we talk a lot about having a diverse student population or where is the diversity, but diversity for me is just the first step. It's not enough just to have more people of color, more African Americans, more Latinos, more Asians in the U.S. context. It's not just enough to have more women. It's not enough to have more, people who identify as gender fluid. That's not enough. That really inclusion is when we have involvement and empowerment. So inclusion is when you create an environment, a safe space where individuals are comfortable in expressing themselves. And the inclusion also, for me, suggests that the institution, the organization, the university, the school really sees the difference as something that is useful and is helpful and embraces it. And it's really kind of harnessing this diversity and seeing it as a positive and creating a space where we all learn and can be better human beings and evolve better. Mm-hmm.
You know, it reminds me of this analogy that I heard you may have heard of the chocolate chip cookie analogy. Some organized community organizers will use it where you might have an organization that is not particularly diverse, but the issue in which they focus on requires the input and participation of communities of color. And so there's an effort to say, well, we need to make our coalition more diverse. And it creates this chocolate chip cookie type dynamic where the batter, the original batter is essentially the same. And then there's like some quote unquote chocolate chip sprinkled on top. And people say, look, the issue with that is that the batter doesn't fundamentally change.
No.
People can eat around the chocolate chips. Right. They can pick out the chocolate chips, whatever. The batter itself is essentially the same. But if you want to create an inclusive type structure, all of a sudden the batter becomes very different because you're putting in different ingredients. It's going to taste different. It's going to smell different. It's going to be a different experience as opposed to the same experience with some things sprinkled on it.
Right? Absolutely right. So diversity is much more superficial, whereas inclusion is much more integral. It's much more in-depth. Absolutely. So like I was reading something about the difference is a diversity is being invited to the party and inclusion is being asked to dance. I thought that was a really nice way to think about it.
I like that. Yeah. I like that. So we've got a question from one of our online listeners. This comes from Victoria, and she asked that she'd be interested in learning ways in which education can break gender bias in the classroom setting and promote an inclusive learning environment. So I think that's a great segue into, what are some specific things educators, teachers, professors can start thinking about when addressing gender and creating an inclusive space?
I think that's a great question, Victoria. Hi, Victoria from Nigeria. So I think as an educator, the first thing an educator can do and must do, I think, is to do some serious examination of one's own biases, right? Because it's not like we are without biases. It's impossible to be without biases. We all have biases. So I think, you know, the work that you want to do as an educator is just to really be conscious of them and be able to interrogate your own assumptions, your own biases. You may enlist the help of a colleague, a friend, another teacher to videotape you in the classroom as you're teaching to see if you are calling on boys more than girls, or the way in which you may be using language that affirms some and degrades others. Video is a really nice tool to use to be able to help you with this reflection process. You may also enlist assistance from your colleagues to if not using a video, just to have a colleague come into the classroom and observe what you're doing in the classroom and whether or not what biases seem to surface. That's one way to be thinking about it. I think at the primary school level, Victoria, I think it's really helpful for teachers or educators to think about one of the things that we do in classrooms is we tend to segregate. So we tend to, whenever we have to do any kind of grouping, we have boys on one side, the girls on the other side. I was a Peace Corps volunteer, as we mentioned before. And I was in a community junior secondary school in Botswana, and there were some really clear gender roles and gender assumptions. And one of them that I really tried to work on the people who always clean the classroom, they were always the girls cleaning the classroom. That was the expectations. The boys sat back. So of course the expectation was that students come in, they maintain their own classroom environment. But the maintaining of the classroom environment was always the girls doing the sweeping, always the girls doing the trash collecting, etc. And I think that as an educator, a teacher, you can challenge that. And if you see your students kind of falling into some of these ascribed roles, to actually question that and say, listen, let's get some boys to do this too. So just kind of change that those gender arrangements. That's something that you can do. I think you also can monitor your language as an educator. So this is back to kind of being the reflective practice, but monitor your language and try to be a little bit more gender neutral. So some of the things that we talk about is the way in which we often talk about gender. We say it's a social construction, but we still find ourselves, and this is something that I constantly struggle with, and I do gender work. I think about gender quite a bit. But one of the things that I'm personally working through is to really be a little bit more to be a little bit more attentive to always setting things up as a gender binary. So gender binary is this idea that there's a boy and there's a girl, and that's it, right? As opposed to the way in which we're thinking about gender now, that it's a continuum and individuals locate themselves somewhere on this continuum, so that gender is fluid, right? And so I have to struggle, I have to kind of think about that a little bit more and move past this boy-girl binary that I always seem to set up and create space for people who have different notions of gender. So gender fluid or, yeah, are, individuals.
What I find, I can understand what's challenging about that when it comes to language,
yeah,
when viewing gender as being fluid or not as being binary, but more as right. a spectrum is, what are the words in between, or I don't even know if that's yeah. the right way, that sets up as a binary, but between boy and girl and between man and woman that represents or communicates what's in between that space along that spectrum.
Yeah, so I think, you know, gender fluid, I'm still learning the different terminology, right? I'm gender fluid, gender spectrum, gender nonconforming, you know, and each kind of word signals a different element or different nuance to it. I'm still learning. I'm still struggling my way through it. I love that the conversation is advancing, because I think when we, you know, the women's movement really talked mostly or framed gender in a binary for the most part. And now I think where we are in the conversation around gender, we're really moving to the space where we're trying to be more inclusive of individuals who are more gender fluid, who may not identify boy, they may not identify girl or woman or man, that they identify somewhere on that spectrum. And it's a whole wide spectrum. That's one of the things that I'm trying to work through as well, to be a little bit more inclusive around and to move past a gender binary.
You're listening to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series searching for ways to create a world free of violent conflict and finding them in the stories of people around the globe who are making peace possible. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and on today's show, we're speaking with Dr. Alana Lancaster, Senior Program Officer at the United States Institute of Peace and a globetrotting, peace-building trainer and educator. And we invite our listeners and viewers to share your questions and comments with us throughout the show. You can post your comments on the Peace Frequency webpage at the bottom. If you're watching us on Facebook Live, you can post your question in the discussion forum underneath the feed. And you can tweet your questions and comments using the hashtag #YouthPeaceEquality. And we're talking about gender inclusivity, particularly in the classroom. And I want to continue on that. We have a question from Michael on Facebook. Kind of building off of what Victoria's question was, other things that teachers can do to foster gender inclusive conversations and interactions. And I thought maybe you could take it to looking at what we can do at the community level. So you talked a bit about individually as teachers, we can interrogate our own gender biases more and take certain steps to be able to do that. And you started to move a little bit in how the community in the classroom amongst the students can also be shaped in order to create a gender inclusive environment, ways in which activities are set up, the classroom is set up perhaps, how students are encouraged or discouraged to interact with one another. So what are some ways that at the community level in the classroom that can create a gender inclusive space?
So I think similarly, I mean, the work, so we know that, and I appreciate your question, Michael, thank you. So we know that schools do not exist in a vacuum. We know that schools are part of a broader ecology and they're embedded in broader communities. So I really appreciate this question. I think we also know that the boundaries between school and the broader community are very porous. And we know that in the case of, if I may return to my doctoral or my scholarship and research around South Africa and Johannesburg, you know, we have most of my work was examining secondary schools, and we know that there are a lot of young people, youth, who are out of schools. It's a fluid interaction between those students in school and those students out of school, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of interaction of youth out of school and youth in school. So I think similarly, so I appreciate again this question. So I think we can think about moving conversations around gender, some of the same techniques that we use into the broader community, whether it be the church or the mosque. We can think about some of the the broader school or youth support or youth centers as well. So all the civil society organizations who are supporting young people and youth, all the same techniques in terms of trying to adopt gender neutral language and avoiding sex stereotyping around gender assignments and roles that genders should take on, the sensitivity to the way in which you engage other people and give feedback, all that has application in the broader community. Mm-hmm.
We have a question from Kate on Facebook, okay. And she says, what if you're an outsider to the culture and it's not appropriate to try and change gender dynamics?
That's a great question. I work in a lot of communities where I am an outsider. I mean, I think there are ways in which you can be an ally. I think you can find people who are from the community. As I mentioned before, I'm an educator and trainer, so I really believe in the power of learning. I think you can be behind the scenes and work with people who are open and interested. I think there are a lot of people in communities who are really interested in creating gender inclusive spaces. And I think it's really important that the message comes from members inside that community as well. So my suggestion would be that you be behind the scene and do some capacity development work with your allies. Just be an ally to the community, and so be behind the scenes working with them. But I appreciate that. I think that you know it's important not to to be imperialistic in your work and in trying to advance an agenda of being gender inclusive. I think it's really important that you not be imperialistic in that. So work with those who are already doing the work. There's so many people in the space who are doing this work. So work with them.
Let's go a little bit further on the not being imperialistic.
Yeah, I thought you were going to talk about that.
Let's go there. So sure. I understand where you're coming from. I'm sure many of our listeners understand where you're coming from, not being imperialistic. But when does not being, quote, imperialistic start to bleed into a sense of cultural relativism where we see things, actions, behaviors, structures that are harmful? They're something we would consider violence. Yeah. Hard to watch. It's hard to be a part of. It's hard to sanction in some way. Do you just let that go in the name of not being imperialistic? I just want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly.
Well, the way in which I interpreted the question, so I appreciate that. And that is, I think, an enduring tension and debate, the one between cultural relativism and universalism. Mm-hmm. So universal notions and universal rights. It's a constant debate. How do you do that well? Like, how do you, traverse that fine line? It really is a fine line. It's not easy. It's not easy to do. So I think that, I think that some of that, as an individual, I think that one sees inappropriate gendered behavior, I think as an individual, absolutely pointed out. Of course, maybe using the, I when you say this, I feel this way, et cetera. I think it gets a little bit more challenging when you start working in institutional capacity, right? So I think that's where, and I haven't worked this one out. It's unresolved for me. It's really unsettled for me, which is, I think, a good thing. And I want to return to this idea that gender is an action, right? And if you want to be, if work towards a gender inclusive learning environment, you are dealing with these challenges of when to say something and when not to say something. So I think at an individual, it depends on the space. It's really context specific. So for example, as you mentioned before, I train peacekeepers. And so if someone says something problematic in a training, it depends on where we are in the curriculum and the content. And I may take a moment and make it a teachable moment, a learning moment, but I may also have a decision, make a decision to talk to the person who said something that I think is problematic, you know, especially when you're dealing with the military and ranks and et cetera, it's tricky. I may then, you know, talk with the individual outside of the classroom environment. It's so context specific about that behavior and when to challenge it and when to take it on. But we know that if it goes unchallenged, problematic notions of masculinity or femininity then reproduce themselves, right? So we have to interrupt it. But the way in which we interrupt it, I'm nervous to give a blanket statement about how do you interrupt it, right? Because I think it's really context specific, not just for where you are, but who you are, who the audience is, et cetera.
I like that word interrupt. I think that makes a lot of sense.
The thing about working with making gender inclusive spaces and creating gender inclusive spaces is, you know, you have to have a conversation about, and especially as we're talking about the trainings I'm doing right now, you have to have a conversation about problematic masculinities, problematic positive and negative masculinities. And it's a lot of work to have people it's hard work to have people to start questioning the way in which they're socialized and the ways in which individuals perform masculinity. It's hard work and it can often go wrong. And it's often difficult to get back on track. And there's always an issue of time. And there's always an issue returning to the earlier question, who am I as a woman, an African American woman, you know, to talk to some of my colleagues or to share with some of my colleagues in a very different context, what right do I have and how do I resonate with them because I am different and I have a different agenda. And, so it's a struggle. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure if I answered your question, but I'm still working through it, I guess, is what I'm saying.
No. Thank you for sharing that. And I know there's sensitivities around you can share certain parts of a story, but obviously not all of it. So I appreciate it. I think that's really helpful. You mentioned something, and we're going to touch a bit more on negative or violent forms of masculinity in a bit. But I want to get to it now because what my experience has been over the last several years around men, peace and security, or women, peace and security, gender and violence, is interrogating masculinity. What are negative forms of masculinity? What are positive forms of masculinity? I have not heard that much, or I haven't been part of conversations around positive forms of femininity and negative forms of femininity. And in fact, I don't even know if I could explain to somebody what does femininity look like in the same way that I could explain what masculinity looks like. And that's probably in part because, you know, I'm a man and I was raised that way to certain masculine structures and things like that.
Yeah.
So I'm more comfortable explaining that. I have the vocabulary, I guess. So I guess my first question is, before we get to violent negative and positive forms of masculinity, what are positive and negative forms of femininity?
Yeah, so I need to do a little bit more work on that myself because like you, I think I have a blind spot around that. And that is my attention has always been, and my research and my scholarship has been more around positive and negative masculinities, and it has been around femininity in the way in which women perform femininity. But I think, let me get back to you on that. I don't want to answer that and answer it incorrectly.
Yeah.
But that is a blind spot. And that's something that I have been thinking about, but I have not articulated and was not ready to answer.
Right.
To be honest.
Yeah.
So, but I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I
think we can post it to our listeners as well too.
Please,
I think that's a great question for us to learn here at Peace Frequency at USIP.
Yeah,
I mean, if folks are watching on Facebook or listening on the Peace Frequency webpage, how do you define or how do you view femininity and what are positive forms of femininity and what are negative forms of femininity? Please share that with us on Facebook and on the Peace Frequency webpage so that we can learn from you and your experiences. We have another question from Twitter, Facebook. And the question is, how can activity-based, quote, skill practice play a role in creating inclusive classrooms?
So absolutely. I mean, I assume that's like, thank you. I'm assuming that's things, if I understand that question correctly, skill practice being how are you doing, how are you applying skills or, yes, I will take it that way about the application of skills. I think there is, I mean, you can do role plays as an educator. If you're thinking about, for example, let's say you're doing a play. Let's say this is in your literature class or your English class or French class, whatever. And you're looking at literature and you're doing a unit on play. To think really about when there's a male role or a female role, to think about you can be gender neutral. So something that's been written as a female role, you can have a male act that out, and something that's a male role, a female can act that out. I also think that, you know, you can use another way to do this is if you think about literature, children's books, for example, and we know in the U.S. that many of our children's books, our fairy tales, are very gender problematic, and that they reproduce problematic notions of, so a girl, it's, you know, the girl, the princess is always waiting for a prince to come rescue her. She's not an active agent in informing and shaping her own destiny. And so one of the things that you can do is actually completely rewrite, work with your learners to rewrite the fairy tale so that women do have some agency, and maybe it's a man who's being rescued, right? So there's lots of different ways in which you can reenact, and you can think about how to use gender in different ways.
I have to mention this. So I read lots of fairy tales, a decent amount of fairy tales, because again, my daughter's 4.5.
Right.
And, you know, you go through phases with kids on books, and they'll want to hear the same book every single night for a while. And she went through a Little Mermaid phase.
Yeah.
And wow. So we read The Little Mermaid, and Allison, my partner, you know, she did a great job, because we started reading it. And I read it the first time. I said, Allison, read this. I mean, the subtle and not so subtle message that are coming across about men, women, boys, girls, beauty, whatever.
Right.
And one of the parts of this story says that when Ariel, the Little Mermaid, turns 16 or something, she's allowed to go up to the surface to see the human world or whatever. Mm-hmm. And my partner Allison immediately picked up on that, and she just read it differently and said, at 16, right, she chooses to go up to the surface. You know, it's not like someone's preventing her from whatever. And then there's a scene where she saves the prince who she ends up marrying or whatever, and so we read it out where, you know, he's about to die, he's drowning, he can't swim,
right,
and this storm waters and all this kind of stuff, he fell overboard, and the Little Mermaid, she's strong enough and capable enough to be able to save this prince, right. He would die without her,
right.
And so, you know, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's all over the place.
Yeah,
and it's almost, you can drown in it when you have these types of conversations, and you interrogate yourself and you interrogate the messages that are around you. All of a sudden, there's no place you can look where all of a sudden you're like, I'm receiving these messages. My daughter, my son is receiving these messages. I'm regurgitating them without even knowing it.
Absolutely.
It can be very overwhelming.
Yeah. And especially when, as you mentioned, I mean, let's not even talk about advertising, right? And I'm just saying, I spend so much time on the continent. And one of my biggest, I always get so upset about this, but I tell you, in some cities, billboard after billboard is for whitening cream. Always women, never men whitening their skin. But this, again, like, so that intersection of race and class, and gender, about the standard of beauty, right? And Ariel, like, you know, how she's portrayed. But the messages are just constant, they're everywhere. So it's you know, you're working really hard against the system, really, if you think about it, because, you know, luckily, you're all this work that you're doing, and there's just so much messaging going on that is really working against you to reinforce ascribed gender roles.
Totally. We have another question from one of our online listeners, from Tracy. She says, at the university level, when you have students living on campus, what are some strategies for promoting gender inclusive spaces and gender equality in student housing, particularly when you have students coming from different cultures and countries? That's very interesting.
That's a great question. Yeah. And I have to say, Tracy, that may be beyond my expertise. I'm not really that familiar with housing. I would love to. I wish Tracy could talk a little bit about this. I really have not given that much thought. I can't really answer that.
Yeah, no, Tracy, it'd be great if in that forum space, if you could add a little more context.
Please.
If there's like a, you know, obviously without using names of universities or students or whatever, but flesh that scenario out a little bit for us and all of our listeners, because perhaps someone who's listening or watching could chime in on that. But yeah, that's a really good question. Really good question. You are listening to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series searching for ways to create a world free of violent conflict and finding them in the stories of people around the globe who are making peace possible. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. And on today's show, we're speaking with Dr. Alana Lancaster. She's a senior program officer at the United States Institute of Peace and a globetrotting peace builder, trainer, and educator. And we continue to invite our learners, our viewers on Facebook, post your questions online or underneath the live feed on Facebook, or you can tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag Youth Peace Equality. We're talking gender inclusivity in the classroom. And we already touched a little bit on masculinity, femininity. And so I want to delve a little bit into these positive and negative forms of masculinity. And there's a video that, at least in my Facebook feed, I'm not going to say this for everyone's Facebook feed, but has gone a little viral. And it is a performance of a poem called We Are the Lions. And it's a piece that was produced in association with MEND, which is an organization that engages men to think differently about their role in culture and to become catalysts of cultural change. And so I want our listeners to know that we're going to play it. It's about 5 minutes. And I want our listeners to know that it does involve some language that may be not suitable for children. So if you have kids listening, maybe step away for about 5 minutes. And then to our folks on Facebook, you're not going to be able, actually, you will be able to hear it. But if you want to Google We Are the Lions poem, it should pop up. It's on YouTube. I think it's on MEND's webpage as well. So you can check it out. But I'm going to bring it up now and we can listen to it and then talk a bit about it. And here we
I don't have a problem with pornography. I mean, I don't get upset when I see sexually exploitive commercials. In fact, those are usually my favorite ones. I mean, I don't know what her ass has to do with my hamburger, but I'm in a drive-thru the very next day. I have a problem with violent movies or images or the word bitch. Don't have a problem with jokes about women. In fact, I freely admit there are times where I sit back with my fellas and kick back, talk about some bitch and how I wish I could hit that, talk openly in public places. I'm concerned if your kids laugh. I mean, it's just words, just jokes, just dudes talking shit that you never expect's going to get back. However, I do have a problem with violence and cruelty, and rape and abuse. And even if we know it's just me, it's just you. It's just a few harmless chokes between me and my dudes. It still perpetuates a culture where it's easy to confuse the link between the jokes and the bruise, between her getting choked and what's just jokes between dudes. And if there's a connection between the things I don't have a problem with and the things that I do, then perhaps I need to rethink my views on the way we view women and how many views sexually exploitive images get on YouTube. My best friends have beautiful children. And if what I have to do to keep their daughters from getting raped or harassed or abused is choose to accept domestic violence as a man's issue too, then I'll do that. And if their sons grow to be like the men that they see, so it's on me to live like the men I want them to be, then I will do that too. And when they're of a certain age, I will tell them this story I heard when I was young about this village being terrorized by lions. See, every so often in this village, the villagers would wake to find beds ransacked, bodies torn, and for some odd reason, the bodies were always female. Panicked, the men of the village started sleeping in shifts to make sure at least one man was always watching. Despite that, the lions came. Too worried to sleep now, the mothers crept to the beds of their babies, and there, watching over them, they learned why the victims were never men. Because on random nights, for unknown reasons, as the fog crept in and the moon caught in the branches, the boys and men of the village became the very thing the women they loved feared most. When I was young, I thought that story was about lions. It's not. See, we are children. The monsters are under the bed. When we are adults, the monsters have moved. They are inside us. They fight us. They climb in bed beside us. And so to stay safe from danger, we raise our girls to believe they must avoid it. And we raise our boys to believe they must become it. And so they do. And then one day, they grow up to discover they are the lions. They are the ones you're watching out for. They are the ones. We ask her, what did you do? When we should ask him, what have you done? But we don't. As if we can't blame him, as if it's her fault for failing to accept that being safe around men, that's not safe to expect. I mean, she got in a cage with a lion. She deserves what she gets. And as men, we have to reject that mindset or the violence won't end. We have to accept most often it starts in the hands and hearts and minds of men. And we are the lions time and again. And if we aren't the lions, we are on their side. Too often standing proudly in defense of the pride, perhaps afraid that if we stand with women against the lion, we will ourselves be devoured. And so, ironically, to prove we aren't cowards, we become cowards. To prove we aren't weak, we become weak. To prove we are still lions, we become sheep, unwilling to do the one thing that must be done. Speak. And our silence chokes as heavy as hands. It stings in every black eye where men stand. Violence lives or dies. And that is why to call this just a women's issue is a lie. We must be involved. This is a problem that cannot be solved with our silence. If we want to end the violence, we must speak. We must act. 1 in 5 women are raped by men. We must own that fact. 640,000 women and girls are trafficked for sex annually. We must own up to that. 3 women are killed each day by men who say they love them. That fact is ours and ours alone. Domestic violence is ours to own. This is what we must understand. This violence ends where it starts, in the hands and in the hearts and in the minds of men, because we are the lions. Time and again.
So that was a poem written and performed by Steve Connell called We Are the Lions. And as I mentioned before, it was produced in association with MEND. That's M-E-N-D, M-E-N-D. That's an organization that engages men to think differently about their role in our culture and to become catalysts for cultural change. So, Alana, I wanted to talk a bit with you about this poem. And the first question, when you hear this poem, what does it conjure up for you as a woman?
The power of spoken word. I want to begin by saying that. I think it's, problematic masculinity needs to be addressed by men. And I appreciate that we have allies like this particular artist who is able to articulate this. So I mean, going back to the earlier question about as an outsider, I mean, I'm a woman and I train majority men, and messages around masculinity, I'm not always in the best position to talk about that, and men are. So I really appreciate the work that's being done by organizations like MEND and Promundo and all these organizations. There's one in South Africa that's escaping me right now. But all these organizations are doing work around masculinity and how do you interrupt? How do you interrogate? How do you change these notions of what it means to be a man? I'm grateful for that, because we can't do the work as women alone.
Right. What do you think about his lion analogy? You know, is this something that you have encountered in either your research or your experience as a peace building trainer or educator?
And on a very personal level as well, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, he talks about women and girls being targeted by members of their own community. And I think about that, and, you know, growing up and being like, I matured relatively early. And so I had a body of an old, you know, and we see this all the time, right? I was 11 and I had a body, and I was always being harassed by men who were sexualizing me and propositioning me. And it was, I didn't have the emotional maturity. While I'd like to think I was mature, I didn't have the emotional maturity to deal with that. And I think that's real. I think what really strikes me about this particular spoken word piece is that he really is talking about these members are our brothers, our fathers, or our uncles. This is happening within the community. We know the rates of violence against women, whether it be intimate partner violence, whether it be, you know, rape and assault. I mean, it's the numbers are staggering, and they are brothers and fathers and friends. I mean, it's not like these are, you know, it's that the lions are within the community. And I think that's right. And unfortunately, we see that also in school environments as well. I mean, both within the classroom, we see sexual violence perpetrated against boys and girls by their peers. And we see it being perpetrated by teachers and educators, administrators. And we see it even outside in this broader school community, where literally men are preying on girls and boys as they walk to school. They're preying on them. And it's unfortunate. But I really appreciate that he and organizations like Men are doing this kind of work. It's imperative that they do.
I think it's important you said, you know, these are fathers, brothers, close friends that, you know, he starts that poem talking about, oh, I'm sitting around having this conversation. We use this language. Yeah. We talk about these things, and it's just normal. And we let it go. We don't say anything.
Yes.
You know, have you ever had to, going back to this idea of interrupt someone who's close to you? I mean, in many ways, that's the most difficult one, where it's like, look, I love this person. I respect this person. And it's harder now to say, like, I can't believe you just said that or did that.
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah. Going back to your male role model, your grandfather.
Yeah.
Were there specific experiences that you had with him where, now reflecting back on it, you know, he was someone that gave you either the language or the model to look at other men and say, you don't have to be like that, or you don't have to say that, because I have a male role model that thinks differently about it? Or the flip side is, you know, no one is perfect, or even our role models can struggle with things. In this relationship with your grandfather, how has that influenced your perception of gender and being able to speak out to address issues of gender?
Yeah, so I think my grandfather modeled behavior as the way in which he respected my grandmother, and the way in which he passed on respect of women to my father. My father and my mother, I think, I think in many ways they have more expansive notions of the role as what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman. And I think it's similar to what I hear you talk about, you and your partner, with your partner Allison, that, you know, you have different notions, and you work actively to kind of to interrupt that. And so, you know, I think my father passed this idea of respect of women to my father, and my father has passed that along, you know, to us as well. So, you know, I did not see, but again, my grandfather was my grandfather, so I'm not saying I saw everything all the time,
right.
I could just see the way in which he respected my grandmother, and the way in which he respected my aunties, and the kind of man that my dad is, and the way that my dad really respects my sister and I.
Mm, that's great. We have a question from Mickey. This is from Facebook. And the question is, what are your thoughts on restorative justice practices becoming standard disciplinary action in public schools? And I'm going to tweak it a little bit, just because we're focusing on gender.
Yeah.
A lot of these disciplinary actions can be a result of gender-based violence, and the way in which different genders treat each other based on that. You know, I don't know how familiar you are with restorative justice, but how do you see restorative justice as a practice influencing these conversations and these issues around gender?
Yeah, I mean, to answer Mickey's question, I think it's a great question. Yes, restorative justice should be integrated into school systems. Absolutely. Yes. And especially if we think about what's happening in the U.S. and the U.S. school systems, and the way in which it's an institution that is punishing and surveilling, and how we could use restorative justice, thank you, to change those messages. So absolutely, we need to do more of that work.
That's great. We're coming to the end of our show. You're listening to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series searching for ways to create a world free of violent conflict, finding them in the stories of people around the globe who are making peace possible. I'm your host, Aaron Cambridge, and my guest on today's show is Dr. Alana Lancaster. She's a senior program officer here at USIP. I'm a former Peace Corps volunteer and a globetrotting peace builder, trainer, and educator. And we've been talking about gender, gender inclusivity, particularly when it comes to education and classrooms. But we are coming to the end of our show, so we just have time for a couple more questions. If you're a listener or a viewer, bring it in, and I'll try and weave it into the show. I want to bring back in one of the questions that we had posted online over the last couple of weeks as part of the 60 Days of Engagement, to encourage people to think about and reflect on gender. And one of those questions is, what is a stereotype about your gender that bothers you or you find damaging, violent, or runs counter to the values of peace?
There's so many.
Where to begin? And our listeners think about this as well too, and maybe post your response on Facebook or online. It's a tough, deep question.
Yeah, I think for me, as late, one of my struggles, right, honestly, is a little bit about, I'm assertive. I'm very assertive, but I often feel like, you know, in being assertive, is not necessarily appreciated in all environments. I think speaking truth to power is also not always appreciated. And I think speaking truth to power is more palatable when it comes from a male voice than it is a female voice. And so, yes, I think that's, I would talk about there, you know, levels of assertiveness, and you should be assertive, but only so assertive. Yeah.
All right. So the stereotype being that women and girls should not be assertive, or
that women and girls should not be assertive, that women and girls kind of hold on and internalize their feelings and emotions, and they should not express them. And I think, you know, talking about women internalizing some of these messages and policing, I think women police other women on this one as well. So, you know, we internalize, and I think it's a constant struggle with, you know, saying too much or not saying enough. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, we're supposed to take that on, and we're supposed to internalize it. And I also think maybe the message around this notion or idea that women should be caretakers, and they should be taking care of everyone, and not receive assistance and help. I struggle with that too. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
So it was mentioned at the beginning of the show that this 60 Days of Engagement spans 3 days that are celebrated around the world. Right. August 12th was International Youth Day. Yeah. And coming up on September 21st is the International Peace Day. And in fact, USIP is running a campaign with the hashtag Peace Day Challenge. And the Peace Day Challenge exists to raise the profile of the International Day of Peace and to affirm peace as a real alternative to the violence we see every day in the news. It's all about inspiring a day of action on September 21st, focused on building peace through real life activities and sharing those on social media using the hashtag Peace Day Challenge. And in 2015, last year, the Peace Day Challenge reached 21 million people in 129 countries on social media. It engaged dozens of organizations and inspired activities in 36 countries and 21 states in America. USIP will be continuing this campaign this year on September 21st. So keep an eye out for that. So my question is, what did you do last year for International Peace Day? And what was your Peace Day Challenge?
Yeah, I was trying to think about this.
Yeah.
I think I was training peacekeepers or just returning from training peacekeepers. I was in the field.
Okay. Yeah that's a big challenge. It's like bigger than most. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I went to my kid's school and read some books. So
right on.
Yeah, which, you know, it's good.
Yeah.
And what do you plan to do this year for the Peace Day Challenge?
I'll be on my way to the International Association of Peacekeeper Training Centers. This year, the meeting's going to be held in Sarajevo. So I will be probably preparing and thinking about a thematic discussion that will be facilitating around gender and masculinity in the peacekeeping environment. So I'm very practical. I mean, we're lucky here at USIP in that our work is you know, daily.
Right.
Peace building.
Yeah. They're challenging, but it's not necessarily a challenge because of what we do every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for folks who don't work at USIP, don't work at a peacebuilding organization, aren't a globetrotting peace builder like yourself, what are some suggestions you have for, you know, everyday folks, a type of Peace Day challenge that they could do on September 21st?
Yeah. So I would think, I would say one of the things that they can do is do some serious reflection and think about maybe creating a list of things that they would like to work on around gender and challenging gender norms and gender assumptions and that they can actively do. I would also say, I really think there's a lot of work that can be done one-on-one with transformation and having transformational conversations. So, you know, have those conversations, have those difficult conversations with friends. I think it could also be, you know, to be active or educate yourself on some of the movements out there around, you know, perhaps the prison industrial complex if you're in the U.S. or, you know, there are just a lot of opportunities to around Black Lives Matter and again in the U.S. context. And of course, follow the Peace Day Challenge and follow the wonderful work that Aubrey is doing as well. So we have resources here that can be tapped into. Lots of things you can do.
That's great. And I really like that in terms of the importance of reflection, having those conversations, because you mentioned this earlier that sometimes it's really difficult, particularly with loved ones, to ask that question or bring up that prompt because it can create a very uncomfortable conversation, a difficult conversation. And sometimes it's that initial opening of the door that is so hard to do.
Absolutely.
And you need some type of occasion to do it.
Right.
And September 21st could be that day. Perfect. If you've had that question and you've wanted to talk to your brother or your mother-in-law or your aunt about this thing or this friend of yours that said this or did this, and you've been wanting to say something or have a conversation, that hard conversation about it, the door is, hey, you know what? Today's September 21st, International Peace Day. I don't know if you knew that, but I've had this question I wanted to ask you, and I'm just going to take today to ask it because I think it could create a really good conversation. And so I think that that's an opening that people should take. So I think it's really good advice.
And as an educator, I'd also like to suggest to our educators out there who are listening to check out the toolkit that they can find on the website here. And there are really they're in the toolkit for both middle school and high school. There are practical activities and exercises that teachers can bring into their classroom immediately, part of a one-off or part of a more intentional long-term program to integrate peace studies and peace building into the classroom. So that's a great tool. And it is, we have it in Arabic, Spanish, French, and English. So for all our English or all of our Arabic, French, Spanish speakers out there.
That's great.
Yeah.
And you can find that at buildingpeace.org.
Yes, you can.
Again, that's buildingpeace.org. The Peace Builder Toolkit can be found on there for free. Definitely use it. Alana, thank you so much for being on the show today.
I appreciate it.
Our guest has been Dr. Alana Lancaster. She's a senior program officer at USIP, where she specializes in curriculum and training design and delivery, trainer development, and university partnerships. For the past few years, Alana has been one of the Academy's most prolific trainers of African peacekeepers, having led dozens of trainings across the continent. Alana, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
The Peace Frequency is produced by the Global Campus, USIP's online learning platform designed to teach and learn critical peacebuilding skills through distance learning courses, a growing multimedia library of peacebuilding resources, and virtual live events just like this one. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. Our sound engineer and theme music composer is Timothy O'Keefe. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. And I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. Thanks to our listeners for your questions and comments. Be sure to check the Peace Frequency website to access a recording of this show and other archived episodes of the podcast. The URL is usipglobalcampus.org/peace-frequency. Until next time, keep learning, supporting, and building peace.